the Talking Race podcast from the Centre for Race Education and Decoloniality at Leeds Beckett University.
Welcome to this episode of Talking Race. Today, we'll be focusing on the sport media and hearing from BBC sport journalist, producer and broadcaster, Nelson Kumar. Throughout this extended episode, we'll be talking about pathways into the sport media, the importance of role models and support systems, microaggressions and how racism makes you feel so low, and Nelson's role in the BBC Sports BAME Advisory Group and what he and his colleagues bravely did during the summer months of 2020. An overarching theme of this episode is about the importance of talking about our lived experiences around race and racism and using these stories to help shape anti-racist action.
Okay, right. So thanks very much, Nelson, for joining me today. The first question that I'm going to ask is, of all the careers that you could have gone into in the world, what was it that attracted you to work in the sports media?
There's no real simple answer to it. I mean, I was one of those people who went to university and had no idea what I wanted to do when I came out. And so ended up, after getting a decent degree, deciding that I wanted to, I liked radio. I was working in the cinema one day, someone from the local hospital radio came in and asked if we could donate any tickets for free for some of the hospital patients. I said, yeah. And after talking for a few minutes, he said to me, look, I really like your voice. Sounds a bit strange. But he said, would you like to maybe come down and try out at a radio station? I was like, yeah. And anyway, I did it for a few weeks, loved it, and thought to myself, right, I've got no career aspirations at the moment. Why don't I try radio? So I had my degree, but I went to do a BTEC course in radio production. And I did that at South Thames College in Lambeth. And it was just great. It kind of changed my life. It was just everything that I could have like hoped. It was brilliant. I loved radio anyway, but the thought that I could talk on the radio, I haven't got a massive ego, but I just thought that was great. And so a few of us like got really into it, and we just spent all our time at the studios at the college. And I just realized that that is what I wanted to do. It had to be radio. Now, at that point, I didn't know what kind of radio I wanted to get into. Could have been, I knew it wasn't necessarily new, so I was thinking music or sport. And then luckily, one of my lecturers is a guy called Arif Ansari, who works at the BBC, still does now. He said to me, look, I think you're really good. Why don't you apply for one of these BBC kind of like junior journalist courses? And I said to him, well, I don't really want to do news. And he said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, how about sport? And he said, well, they're running this BBC Talent Sports Reporter competition. I was like, a competition? He was like, yeah. So anyway, long story short, I got my application in the very last moment, and I was one of two winners. And the two prizes for getting through were to one of us go to the Olympics in Athens 2004 and the other to go to the Paralympics in Athens 2004. I got to go to the Paralympics like 7 months after I had applied for this competition. So I was lucky. I mean, I don't know if I would have gone through the usual routes had I not won that competition. But once I got inside the BBC, it was just like a drug. It was just amazing. I was working with all these people I'd listened to on the radios, seen on the TV. It wasn't the nicest environment, I would say, but I just thought to myself, I'm in the BBC. I've got a chance now. And so, I mean, there was no one I thought I want to be like that. There are a few radio presenters that I like, but I certainly felt that I could do something in that industry. So yeah, it was quite easy for me in terms of I entered a competition, I got the job, and I've been in radio, TV ever since.
I think the next question is around, first of all, representation is massive. Representation is crucial, and also role models are really, really important as well. Did you have any role models, for example, working in the industry when you were starting out?
No. No. That's not to say there weren't any, although I can't think of any, but there was no one that I thought to myself was in sports broadcasting that I really looked up to. Now, if you're talking specifically black people, if I saw any black people that I thought, right, that's someone I can aspire to be, it's great that I didn't see any. Again, I can't tell you, looking back at that time, that there was definitely none. Like, I thought about this and I thought, Mike Wedderburn might have been on Sky Sports News. He might have been at that time. I can't tell you. But if he was, he wasn't someone that I thought, right, I want to be like that, or I could be like that. At that time, I probably still wanted to be a presenter. I eventually moved into production, but I didn't realise how kind of brutal it was and how you had to be. I remember people commenting to me quite early, are you sure you want to be a presenter? You seem too nice to be a presenter. And I didn't really understand what that meant, but I soon did. And because I met with people who wanted to be presenters and many presenters, and I didn't think they were a bunch that I particularly wanted to be or mix with. But certainly there wasn't anyone who I thought, like, I love Mark Pugach. He had been at Five Live for a while at that time. For a short while anyway. And I remember thinking, he's great. He's white, middle, possibly upper class. And I wasn't going to be like him. I knew that. But, if you wanted a straight answer, I didn't see any role models. Certainly in presenting, very few in production.
I mean, following on from that, we've got to acknowledge that the sport media traditionally and still is a predominantly white male industry. And for example, here's some statistics. So the Black Collective of Media in Sport, otherwise known as BCOMS, they revealed that of the 456 media roles which covered the Olympics, the Paralympics, the European Football Championships and Wimbledon back in 2016, only 44 of those roles were filled by Black, Asian and minoritised ethnic individuals. Excluding former athletes, for example, working as pundits, there were only 8 Black journalists across those 456 roles, and only 1 woman was sent to cover the European Football Championships, and that was out of 456 roles. Now, why do you think that we are seeing these sad statistics?
I mean, that's a tough question. I've got to say, the statistics has kind of blown me away a bit. I knew they'd be bad. You know, if you worked in the industry, yeah, you kind of know, but I didn't know it was that bad. And, you know, the stats around women, are pretty bad as well. I mean, look, there's a number of reasons. I mean, I kind of think of it. If I look back when I walked into the newsroom, sports newsroom, there was about 2 or 3 black people amongst 40, 50, 60, 70. If you counted all the sports people working, it was just hardly any. And that's intimidating. Intimidating because, especially, I remember I came from a competition, people hated that. They hated it, and they absolutely made it clear that they hated it. And I did, for a long time, feel like I didn't belong there because, you know, some people had years and years and years of trying to get on camera, for instance, and then I went to Athens and I was on live TV, live radio. Look, if you're in an industry which is working to your advantage, what is the incentive to change? Like, if you had no, like now there's a bit of pressure on the BBC, on other broadcasters in the industries, there's a bit of pressure because diversity is a big thing. In those days, it wasn't. Like, but you're talking 2016, we're talking just 4 or 5 years ago. Like, I mean, things have changed even quite a lot since then. So 2016 was the year Tony Hall published his big plan for diversity and inclusion at the BBC. And the BBC, you know, recently admitted they had failed in a lot of those targets. And people didn't want to change. Why would you let others in who are a threat? And whether that be women, whether it be gay and lesbians, whether it be disabled, why would people change when they had the run of it? If they'd make you feel, I always felt unwelcome when I went to football matches, when I went to cover any kind of sport. you get the odd person who might see that you're kind of like new and stuff, but I get, you know, I've been to places where I've had other reporters just barge in front of me when I'm about to start an interview and take the first interview. You know, whether that's down to racism, whether it's just down to a bit of privilege, whether it's just, who are you, get out of my territory, you know, you can't prove it. But you kind of like, when you've had an a lifetime of racist experiences, you kind of know, and you don't need people to tell you. But, you know, there's other things at play. Like, one of the things that I can understand was why there was an obsession with degrees and grades. Like, I got a 2-2 at my degree in American studies. Like, it had nothing to do with my... I think that was another thing that really made people resent me. I didn't do a broadcast journalism course. Although I did do the 1 year radio BTEC course, but people just laughed at me when I told them about that. So I think people were definitely undervalued who didn't have qualifications. You know, the general thing about people hiring in their own image, being comfortable about things. You're talking about, you know, like, say at the BBC, we've got, like, Darren Campbell, Michael Johnson, Denise Lewis, people who've been there and done it, you know, Ian Wright. But as you say, you're right. I mean, if you weren't a past sportsman, that kind of gave you an excuse, if you're a broadcaster, I think, to get, you could say, right, we've got this person, we've got that person. But you had to. They were the top sports people in their industry. When it came to journalists, I mean, I don't think anyone really cared that there weren't many black people. Obviously, I cared, we cared, but the other thing was, who was there to talk to about it? You couldn't go up to your white boss and say, I don't think there's enough representation. It just didn't work like that. I've got to say, there was a big thing at the BBC in that we had one guy who absolutely looked out for us. He was black, he's an editor, and he was the only one. And he fought fiercely for black people. He got so many young black people a foot in the door, and it was maybe even a toe in the door, maybe even a toenail in the door, because you get you a week's work experience, and you know, you get the chance. You know, I don't know who he asked to do it, but he just managed something. Every other week there was someone just walking through, like, give them the nod of approval, like, how did you care? Yeah, there's another one of me. It was but he, you know, he fought, and I know he fought against a lot of his white colleagues, and I know a lot of white colleagues got together and said, like, why is he always bringing in these black people? It was an open thing. I don't think they cared that I would hear those things. But had he not done that, it was a 9-month contract I got, which ended at Athens. So Athens was my last thing on that contract. I remember the day I returned to the UK, I literally had to go in and pick up my stuff from the BBC from a locker. There was no one to talk to. It's like, just like, well, your contract's up. And I remember phoning up someone who'd been involved with the scheme, and I said, I just want to make sure, like, is that it? And there was no exit meeting, there was no nothing. It was just, that was it, your time was up. So I made an appointment to see this guy who'd looked after us all. And I said to him, look, I just, like, that's it, I'm done. He hadn't realised that was the case. And he said, what, no one's talked to you? And I said, no. He said, no one's offered you anything else? I said, no, that's it. And it just, for me, it was just amazing. 2004, October time, he took over the rota of BBC Sport freelancers and stuff. And he said to me, look, there's going to be a few changes in a few weeks. I'll get you back in. Just bear with me. And he called me in, made me do a few packages, do a few things, and just, like, maybe prove myself to him. And he said, right, I'll give you some freelance shifts. And they weren't regular, but at least I was still in there. Honestly, no one cared that I was gone. And, you know, I remember, like, at the Paralympics, you know, I remember my boss saying to me, you've done really well here, really like what you've done, how do you fancy being on the live program at the end of the broadcast? I was like, amazing. Like, that was with Claire Balding, Phil Jones, great commentator. And I was like, yeah, I'll do it. I was so nervous. But yeah, there I was at the end of the Paralympics, like, where you had the presenter saying to me, like, what was your favourite moment? So, like, no one had seen me on TV. It was all just weird. But stupidly in my head, I thought, okay, they must like me. They must think it. But literally, that next day I flew home and that was it. That was, like, I was like, well done, you've had your time and there you go. But look, also a major thing is lack of accountability. It's got to be, because if if you have a percentage of staff that is like that and no one is challenging it, no one's questioning it, and there's no rule to say, like, even like that Tony Hall stats that I talked about, like 2016, the fact that the BBC just admitted that they missed those figures, there's no jeopardy, there's no consequence to it. It's just that is what they buried that news. And to me, I thought that was, that kind of summed up, I think, a lot of good intentions, but not a lot happening, I would say. And so it's just strange. You look now at a newsroom and there's plenty of black people, plenty of Asian people, plenty of gay people. And it just seems like a different world, but it's not, because we know the struggles that we've been to get there.
I mean, there's a lot of really interesting things within that response there, talking about accountability, or previously a lack of accountability, talking about the importance of mentors and supporters that can actually open those doors for you, or break those doors down, or leave it ajar. And we've also got the things that you mentioned around being made to feel unwelcome in certain spaces, and those kind of microaggressions that you alluded to there.
It's tough, and like, without trying to, you know, speak down to anything you've done in the past, it's I find it really hard to explain to white people a lot of these things, just because it's so ingrained. You know, I grew up in London, I was born in London in 75. In the 80s, you know, racism was just there all the time, at school, on the streets, on the news, everywhere. So to an extent, I'm used to it. And actually, in the discussions I've had with my colleagues, especially colleagues at work, black colleagues, they lived with it as well, all the time. And we kind of only discussed this amongst ourselves in the wake of George Floyd. So in a way, it's not a shock to me. But, you know, I talked to you about Queens. So I was sent to cover Queens on the radio. So Queens is the tournament before Wimbledon. It's the grass tournament that a lot of the top players go to. And I love tennis, and I'd been part of the tennis team for a bit on off. You know, I helped out Wimbledon now and again. And I was sent to Queens to be the main producer, which was great for me. It was just great. I'd only been to Queens once as a spectator. I was so excited about it. And so it was big. It was, you know, it didn't get masses of listeners. We were over on Sports Extra. But yeah, one day I was wearing a black shirt. And I went to lunch before we went on air. We were due to go on air at 1, so I went down, as I had done most days, just on my own, sat down. And I finished, picked up my tray, and started walking towards the place where you deposit your trays. And as I was going, I got a tap on the shoulder from behind me. And a gentleman, you know, I can only describe him as posh, in his 50s, tweed jacket, just moved something on my tray, put his tray on top of mine, and walked off. So he clearly thought I was a member of staff. And I will say that the staff were wearing black shirts. They weren't all black, but they were wearing black shirts. I'm not trying to defend this guy. And I was taken aback, of course. But I looked at him and I said, "Excuse me, I don't work here." And he looked at me and went, "Oh, sorry," and just walked off. He didn't take his tray away. Just turned away and walked away. Now, that's quite, you know, I mean, that's quite outlandish. I think anyone would find that kind of behaviour. I mean, look, racism makes you feel so low. It really belittles you. It's tough, man. Like, I've spent these last 9 months, 10 months talking about it more than I have in the rest of my life, probably. But I saw a quote last week from Shaka Hislop, who had one of the people who started Show Racism and the Red Card, where it said, "Racism strips you of all dignity. It makes you feel as low as you can possibly get." And I totally got it. I thought it was a great quote, because it's hard to make other people understand that, just how you feel humiliated, embarrassed. And most of the time, if you're living in this country or a white country, you have to accept, you not have to accept it, but you get it. And it's one of those things that you can't do much about a lot of the time. Look, people at work, there are lots of microaggressions, probably more so in the past than there are these days. but you kind of learn to live with them. You don't, like I say, unless you've got a group of people who you really trust, you don't really say much about it. You just kind of go home and live with it. You might have a partner that you can go to and talk about it. But most of the time, and I really found this like as a massive thing last year, lots of us, I'm a co-chair of the BBC Sport BAME advisory group. So we've got a lot of black and Asian people, about 30 of us in the group. Talking to every single one of them, all of them said they never talked about it, never talked to their friends, never talked to their family. I had predominantly white friends growing up, nearly exclusively white. I grew up in Maida Vale, St John's Wood, and you just went home and lived with it. You just went home, and you'd all obviously deal with it in your own way. I was never a violent person, never got angry, so it just kind of stored up in me, you know. I think never told my family what was going on, because you didn't know what to say. You just felt like a bit, I would say, humiliated is the thing. You feel really embarrassed. And so I remember one person saying to me one day at work, in my very early days, "Oh, I wouldn't have expected someone like you to be a presenter. We don't have people like you here." Now, what that person meant, or why, or the person's intention in saying that, you know, to me it was quite obvious what they're saying. I remember talking about that particular incident just last year to people, and speaking to a white person, like all the black people I told it to just kind of shook their head. When I said it to a couple of white people, they said to me, "But do you think he was talking about the colour of your skin?" and you're like, you're laughing, I'm laughing, and that's another massive thing to get over. You know, you tell people about experiences and they say to you, "Is it racism though?" I've had senior people at BBC say to me, "Is it racism?" And actually, I can maybe understand why, when you don't know what it means to go through that kind of thing, why you might say that. But, you know, I would say 99% of the time, we know when someone's being racist, using a microaggression against us, and trying to, you know, basically say, "This is our territory, not yours."
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thanks for sharing your experiences there. And that, I would imagine, resonates with a lot of people who might be listening to this. Looking at, for example, the sports media and diversity and equality, which is certainly at the top of the agenda over the last year with everything that's happened, or specifically looking at race and racism, what exists currently around education for current journalists or aspiring journalists to actually educate them about these things?
I mean, this is kind of tough to answer, in that, you know, all broadcasters will have their own kind of programs. I've spoken to a few in big sports broadcasters, and most of them say it's pretty non-existent. I've, you know, when young journalists come to work at BBC Sport, you know, I kind of like take it upon myself to try and talk to them, try and see how they're getting on and stuff, and ask, you know, about their experiences. And you know, this issue's come up certainly over the last few year, but you know, I don't think you've learned it on courses. I think there might probably be, you know, the odd module or something that you probably learn more than you'd certainly do once you get into jobs, because to an extent, you'd hope that individuals would take it upon themselves to educate themselves or to try and work out these things. But if you're never told that's what you're doing, or you don't know you're doing it, then how are you going to learn? So it makes sense that there would be some kind of education, but then you need there to be an admittance that there's an issue. And that's, you know, people aren't going to come forward and say, "We have a big problem, we need to do this, we need this kind of training." I mean, we've certainly had unconscious bias training, and I think that's something that everyone gets at a BBC. But, you know, I mean, yeah, it's not enough, but I don't know what would be enough. Like I said to you, one of the biggest things I learned last summer was that a lot of my white colleagues had never ever one talks about racism, two mixed with people of color, it just until they got to the BBC. And it wasn't even like racism or naivety, it was just I had no idea. I was just I suppose that is naivety. I just had no idea that these things went on. It's just, and in fairness, and this is what I say about individuals, lots of white colleagues got in touch with us during the summer after some sessions that I think we'll go on to talk about, and express their gratitude in being told these things, in learning about these things, in being given tools to go out and use, or materials to go out and read. And I found that so heartwarming. I mean, like, you might say, oh, it's a bit late, or it took that for them to do it, but they showed willing. And the thing about that showing willing is it kind of carried on from, like, for me, the standout moment from last year was, you know, seeing white people out on the streets carrying placards of all ages, you know, saying a Black Lives Matter. And I still find that an amazing thing. Like, it blew my mind, to be honest. And I just, it kind of gave me hope. It gave me hope that people were seeing it. And I think surely, like, other white people seeing that, like, I might have thought, that's crazy, what's going on here? But they must have at one level thought, okay, something's different here. And, you know, had it not been for COVID, this would have been an even bigger story than it was. And, you know, I just wanted it to carry on. I just thought, this is amazing. You know, I remember a white lady, probably in her 70s, being interviewed on news. And they asked her why she was out. And she said, I've got no choice. And I couldn't believe that answer. And then the second question was like, aren't you worried about COVID? And she said, this is more important. And, all right, it's a great soundbite. Who knows what other people said? But to me, it was just like, oh my God, things could change. They really could, because I had never, ever seen that before. And I never, ever thought that a black life, other black lives would mean anything to white people. And I know that sounds a bit, you know, I'm married to a white woman. Most of my friends are white, inside and outside of work. That was all new to them. The death of a black person wasn't new to me. Wasn't new to many, but the response certainly was. And so to me, I think lots of people learnt from that, and having individual conversations afterwards. And those conversations aren't easy. They're not. And I think there's probably training in the works. Lots of training. It's gonna be tough, and I think people are gonna get it wrong a lot at the start, because my issue has always been, who are the people setting this training? Because they're not coming to me to ask how it should be done or getting my input, and it's essentially going to be a lot of white people. And if they can openly admit that they don't know what it is to be racially abused, if they don't know what it is to suffer racism, if they've not had conversations about race until now, are they the people to be setting any kind of training? And will the sensibilities be right? And I might be shocked, but I just think the sports industry, it shouldn't be as far behind as it is. It shouldn't be that you walk into a press briefing and you're the only black person there, and there's just a feeling of dread that you walk in, like, God, I stand out here and I just don't belong here, certainly in this day and age. And I still know people who go there and say they feel uncomfortable. I'm 45 now. I don't care for ignorance too much. I will be as open and as rude to anyone as they are to me. But I know there's a lot of young people who are intimidated and have left the industry. They, you know, unless you're supported, it can be brutal. Everyone wants to be a presenter, everyone wants to be a producer, and lots of people get left behind. And certainly when I started out, the black people I knew were in junior positions and found it very hard to move up. And there was no, and to be honest, that carried on for a long time. And there was no one kind of saying, this ain't right, or this needs to change. And we lost loads of talented people who have gone on to do other stuff elsewhere. Just because people never saw it, and it wasn't a priority to just about anyone. I know the BBC have done some brilliant in theory, had some brilliant measures in place to try and move things along. But a lot of the time that has resulted in resentment and open resentment and making people who haven't got the confidence to deal with it feel very low about where they are and what they're doing. And I've had so many of these discussions with people. And it's just, I don't know, because I've only worked in the media and sport and radio, and I don't know about other places. Maybe we're really lucky where we are, that there are people actually trying to do something and it wouldn't happen elsewhere. But for me, working in the industry, you know, it's been a long time coming.
And in terms of trying to do something, I know that you've been very busy over the last year and longer, but especially with what happened, the tragic murder of George Floyd. We are talking about this as a nation now, and you're right, 2020 was a game changer. Now, can you tell me a little bit more about the work that you're doing at BBC Sport about highlighting these issues within the institution and trying to educate others as well? What's the work that you're doing there then?
So I don't know exactly what point it happened. There must have been a point when a few of us got together and said, something's got to give, something's got to change. It was so weird last year because we weren't all in the office. From March last year, most of us were at home. So when George Floyd happened, you were living it a lot on your own. You know, had I been at work, I'm sure I would have got together with some people and said, bloody hell, look at what's happening, you know. But you're at home, and so, of course, I could have picked up the phone and stuff, and eventually that's what happened. I mentioned I'm in the BBC Sport BAME advisory group, and that was a massive, massive source of comfort that you had other Black and Asian people to talk about how you were feeling, because what we found out is that no one was talking about it, and people were really getting frustrated that work was going on as normal and it wasn't being addressed. And you know, you could see Sky Sports, BT Sport, loads of other industries making really clear points about where they stood on the issue. Whether you thought it was cynical or not, they were doing that, and I think a lot of people felt that the BBC weren't, BBC Sport weren't. And at one point, a few of us got together and we just decided that it couldn't be hidden anymore. It had to be talked about, because I felt there, even from home, I felt there were tensions from a lot of Black people, but also from white people, because it was uncomfortable. It was just really uncomfortable. Even the people who felt that it was awful what happened to George Floyd didn't know how to express it, didn't know how to go about saying, how are you feeling about things? How has this affected you? Couldn't do it. I've got so many colleagues at work. I know a lot of people. I heard from two people, actually. A good friend of mine, and I was blown away by the fact he phoned me and just said, just wanted to see how you are, and if you need to take any time off, do it. And I just welled up, because just the fact that he even thought to think about how his colleague got on, and I suppose the bigger thing was how many people didn't choose to contact me or others. And so we kind of came to a point where we said, all right, we have to talk about race. We have to talk about it. And we have to talk about it where people aren't going to be scared, aren't going to be like hiding away, aren't going to be worried about saying the wrong thing. And bear in mind, the five of us who decided to go ahead and do what we decided to do had never, ever really got together as a five before and didn't know about each other's experiences. So we had the group where we often just got together and talked. But we decided we were going to talk to the whole of sport about this. Now, sport is made up of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. And we devised a way to talk to heads of departments and said, look, we want you to bring your department, make it mandatory, and we're going to talk to them about race. At the time, we didn't know what we were going to do. And I think we were quite surprised when they said yes, because then we suddenly thought, oh my God, what are we going to do? Now, to their credit, the bosses were brilliant. To a man and woman, they said, yes, let's do it. There were fears. They wanted to know what we were going to do, but we didn't know what we were going to do. So the day before the first session, we were told we were going to talk to 40 people. There was five of us. We knew we had talked, so we talked individually about our experiences. We booked ourselves half an hour on Zoom, the five of us. And that half hour turned into 3 hours of just us talking to each other about what we had experienced. And one of the guys on my team, he grew up, when I was living in Westbourne Park, he grew up 10 minutes from me down the road, but we never knew each other, never saw each other. And we worked together in sport in London as well. Didn't know that we had lived next to each other. And he told me some of his experiences and they were the same as mine. And we just both cried at each other because we were like, we could have helped each other, had we known. And it was an amazing experience. One of the team grew up in America and she talked about her experiences, which were completely different to ours. And, you know, and then there was Asian people who talked about stuff. I had never really considered Asian people and what they had gone through and what it was like being mixed race. And it just blew us away that we all had these experiences. And I think by the end of it, by the way, this was the day before our first session was due to be delivered. We were so exhausted. And like the next day, we messaged each other an hour before. Bear in mind, people told us there were going to be 40 people. I look back over the messages now. So they were the first messages we sent in these WhatsApp groups. And it was like, I feel sick. What are we doing? What are we going to say? So, I mean, we had a rough kind of outline of what we were going to do, but we just kind of said to ourselves, let's just talk, man. Let's have a few topics and just hit them. And we had 1 hour and a half booked. And so people came on the call, on the Zoom call. There was just, in fact, we asked for everyone to show their faces because we didn't want people to be logged on and just walk away and do stuff. So show your faces. And lo and behold, there was hundreds. And like, we got messages from each other going, I feel sick, I feel sick, I feel sick. I honestly, this is no lie, I was going to pull out. I was going to message them and say, I've got to go. And I just suddenly thought, what am I doing? What am I doing? What are we going to talk about? And then it was left for me to give some opening marks. And I, you know, those sessions were, they were done in good faith and were a safe space. So I can't really talk about the content of them. But I opened up saying that this is a chance for us to be open. We want you to ask your questions, talk to us. We're not speaking on behalf of every black person or Asian person, but we can tell you our experiences and for you to understand what it means to grow up in a white country being black and Asian. And I didn't get through the first minute without crying. And it was just quite hard because, you know, I knew a lot of the people that I was looking at and I didn't know how they would react to it. But at that point, it got to a point where we couldn't stop. I felt I had to do something. I'm in no way a leader at work. I've got a quite senior position, but I'm not like a boss. And I just couldn't bear it anymore. I just couldn't bear that. No one was speaking up for us or anything. So, you know, there was no bosses involved in it. We were all just staff who decided something had to change. And we got to 1 hour and a half and we hadn't covered like half of what we were doing. And so we messaged one of the bosses and said, can we just continue for 2 hours? He said, yeah. We said to anyone, if you want to go, you can go. It's fine. Everyone stayed. And it was tough. It was tough because a lot of what came out, it was for the first time. And we said, look, if you don't want to ask questions outright, send messages to me. I'll read them out anonymously. And we were getting questions and people asking stuff. And it was just, people wanted to know. People wanted to hear this stuff. And they admitted that they didn't know how to talk to black people about these issues and that it was okay, the mixing in the office, you know, but they didn't want to have to talk about race. They had no idea about it. And it was, we realised how hard it was. I mean, never mind how hard it was for us to talk about it. We realised how hard it was for people to, you know, ask us questions about it. And that was part of it. We were saying, look, we're your colleagues. We're on a level. We're not going to judge you, just ask the questions. And there were some questions that you thought, please, surely you're not asking that. But generally, it blew my mind that people I'd known for years openly admitted they would never know how to start a conversation about it. And they turned put their heads in the sand, essentially. And it ended and we got together, the five of us, with two of our bosses. after to talk about it, and we had nothing left to say. It had just taken everything out of us, and it was kind of like the bosses realised, and they said, look, should we maybe meet again tomorrow? And we all said yes, and by the next day I don't think we even messaged or anything after. I think it was just all a bit much, and the thing was, we signed up to do four of them. there was more people to do it to, and every session got bigger. The second one was about 130 people. I think the biggest was like 180 people from departments outside of sport were coming to these sessions. News bosses came to me saying, do you mind if I come along and sit, because I've heard they've had a real impact. And I can't say they were enjoyable, but they were. We tried to vary them up, we tried to mix them up, but they were hard, because we realised it was the first time we'd ever talked openly about those sessions. But what gave us the strength to carry on was the responses from white and black colleagues. Loads of our black colleagues told us they can never imagine doing that because there were too many things that were triggering. And, you know, just thank you for even taking the time to speak. I got loads of messages saying, like, it feels like we've got a voice. It feels like... And it was so sad that it took that to happen. For people to feel that they belonged, or that they could go to work and feel like themselves. So many people said, I'd never feel like I can be myself. And it was just like... It was like, in some ways, it was the best thing I'd done. But, like, I was having a conversation with one of my bosses about it last week, and we were she just said, how do you feel looking back on everything? And I said, what the F was I thinking doing that? What made me think I could do that? Or, you know, I was half joking. It was great, but it was. I think it had an effect, and I think it had quite a lasting effect on us, because, you know, what next? What were we going to do about it? It wasn't enough to just do that. And, you know, for months after, people were still asking us and trying to get our opinions and stuff and trying to make things better. And it made me realise, you know, it is quite responsibility and quite hard to... I haven't got all the answers. I don't speak on behalf of black. When we go to those BME advisory group meetings, we all have different opinions. Some people are quite militant. Some people are quite... I was of the opinion we had to bring our white colleagues along with us. We had to make them understand it in a way that made them think any schemes, any initiatives, any way forward had to include them, and they had to be a part of it, and they had to understand why it was important and just what the debilitating effects are of racism. And there were people who absolutely argued against that with me, and that was absolutely fine with me. I thought everyone's views valid, and I thought it was important for our white colleagues to actually know that as well, that a lot of black people were just tired and had enough and didn't want to, like, ask for people to come along with us. They wanted to just say, look, we don't have to justify ourselves as people here. Why are we justifying our existence? You know, and there were, it kind of spawned so many more questions. And where does it end? Things have quieted down a bit, but there are lots of things now going on as a result of George Floyd and those sessions and the use of the N-word on a news programme on the BBC. And, you know, even I had to make a conscious decision to take a step back from all of it, because I was getting too involved. I was getting wound up, and I was just like, I wanted to take on everyone's cause. I had people contacting me who I'd never heard of before, just saying, like, you know, how inspired they were and how thankful for that they were. And if I'm honest, it was a bit overwhelming. And, you know, then I had to just work out what my role was going to be in this going forward. All of us did. And it's hard, because I kind of feel now, like, what now? What for the people who may be suffering now? And there's still lots of people, you know, who come to the group meetings and say, this happened or that happened. And, you know, what can I do then? Can I keep challenging these things at a time? But I would say, in their defence, BBC Sport are seriously trying to tackle the problem. Probably not at the speed I'd like. Probably not as rigorously as I'd like. But they are. And I think very well intentioned. But as I said before, I'm not sure we'll get to a place where everyone's happy. Maybe we never can. Maybe we can just hope to make things better. Maybe that's as good as it will get.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, that's such a, a powerful story that you just recounted in terms of what you went through, and it's incredibly eye-opening for those audiences that were growing and learning about your experiences and other people's experiences as well. And I think it builds empathy to actually understand this that they might not have had before. And you touched on it as well in that response there, that I think there's a lot of white people out there who are uncomfortable talking about race, or they don't want to say the wrong thing or come across like they're being racist. And that actually cuts down or prevents these conversations from happening. And it's important that we do talk about race. So what you did and what you went through, and it obviously I'm a white privileged male, so I haven't experienced these things, but it sounds very hard for what you and your colleagues went through to do something like them, put yourself out there. And a tough experience. And I think one other thing that comes to mind is you mentioned about bringing white people along for the journey. And that's really important, that whites need to be allies in the fight against racism. The race work shouldn't be left to Black, Asian, minoritized communities to do all this themselves, because it's hard work and it takes time and it takes energy. And doing this on top of a full-time job, for some people, will reach a breaking point. So we have to be all together in the journey to fight against this, because racism is not something that should be challenged just by people who are affected directly or personally by racism. It affects everybody. So we should all be part of this journey.
Yeah, I mean, like, it does. And I'm not a white person. So I don't know how I'd react if I was a white person, you know, when all these things are happening. I'm sure I would have felt uncomfortable. But, you know, a few things on what you said. Like, it was hard, but I had no choice. There was nowhere else to go. If I hadn't done it, I don't know how I would have carried on being part of BBC Sport, and just, I couldn't have just gone along with it. So I didn't know I was capable of doing what we did, or the others. I couldn't have done it without them for a start. Like, had it been, clearly, it would have been impossible if it was just me saying it. So those guys, like, I loved them forever. And like I say, we didn't know each other before, and we didn't know of their each other's experiences. So that was one big thing. But one interesting thing that came out of it is that, aside from people saying, I never knew, I've never had a conversation about it, is that lots of people commented that they say to me, but Nelson, you never told me. I've always known you. You've always been such a happy-going guy. How can you tell me you've experienced racism from the age of 5, which was the first time a white boy, who was a good friend of mine, called me a gollywog? Like, that was, and I'll never forget that. Through to, like, I would say the last time I experienced it directly was maybe 43. So, like, it spans your life. Now, it's not every day, of course, but, like, so to me, it's just there. So when they said to me, people honestly said to me, I can't weigh up the fact that you've been this person who I've worked with for so many years, but also this other person who's received racism and had to live with it and yeah, at that point, it kind of hit me as well that, yeah, because I don't talk to you about racism. I wouldn't just say to you, oh, this happened to me. I would say it to my wife probably, but, you know, there's no one that I would have gone to and said, man, can you believe that this happened? And that was an eye-opener, and it made me kind of realise that, you know, yeah, I don't know, maybe I definitely try to overcompensate to be a good person, to not have people think anything bad of me, for they might say, oh, it's because he's a black guy. I always try to be overly nice, always try to work extra hard, always try to put people at ease. And I think that definitely over the years took a toll, because then there's a time when you get angry and you get resentful and you just want to, but then you're scared of people seeing another side of you, and you know, and people might be, oh god, he's like that. Like, that's a massive thing for black people, you know, being seen as troublemakers or causing problems or always going on about race or always talking about this and stuff. And like, you weigh it up who's going to accept it? Are people going to turn on you? Are people going to be willing to hear you? And you've got to remember, like, you're saying that now, we're talking about an industry which is mainly white, mainly male, and has existed that way. And opportunities don't come often. And if you think you've got an opportunity at maybe being a presenter or getting a promotion or being a producer, are you going to put your neck on the line? I found it hard to put my neck on the line about certain things. You know, I worried about consequences, how people treat me. And, you know, look, I'll be honest with you, I had good friends at BBC Sport who have not spoken to me since those sessions, not said a word, not dropped a message about them, not said a word. Whether they hated them or thought, you're an idiot, whether they thought, this is so awkward, how am I going to speak to Nelson again? Not a word. And I'm not talking small numbers, a lot of people. I had a lot of people who eventually got in touch with me after a while and just said, look, that was so powerful, I just didn't know how to respond. Because actually there was a meeting when, I think it was kind of like, it must have been a follow-up meeting, or in one of the meetings I said, what I find weird since we've done the first two or three sessions is that people I know were on those calls just haven't said anything. And I just haven't heard from them. I can't go chasing them. I find that so strange. And funnily enough, after I said that, loads of people got in contact and said, I'm so sorry, I didn't know what to say. And I just, it was all a bit hard for them to accept. And I just said to them, you know, it was hard for us. You know, the one thing we needed was a bit of support, not to feel that people were turning against us. And, you know, some of them, they just, people are people, man. We come across lots of different people, and even good people just sometimes, the whole topic and subject overwhelms them. And if you've never had to deal with it in your life, and you've lived a quite privileged life, you might be the correspondent for a sport who's got everything going for them, it's fine. But you might now have kids who are going to grow up with kids of a different background, and they will mix more and more. They'll have to mix, and sometime you're going to have to talk to them, because they'll see these things on TV. I've had to say things to my son. It's just hard. He's seven, but like he doesn't get it. And why should he get it? Because he goes to a school which is predominantly white, and you know, it's just, these things are going to rear their heads in people's lives. And it's made me think about so many things, but it's made me realise that the scale of it is just bewildering, really, on so many levels. And that, you know, if I'm realistically, I can only do so much. I'll keep fighting, but there's only so much I can do, and I can keep talking, and I can do things like this, and I can lend my voice here, but yeah, it's quite, and that's kind of like a sad thing for me, that I think we helped change a lot of people's attitudes, or at least made people think a lot more. But you do think, well, 6-9 months on, what's changed? What's changed in your life? How have, you know, we haven't got back together and asked everyone, what have you done since? You know, how have you felt? But you know, there might be people who like have been profoundly changed and have profoundly looked at how they interact with different races and how they treat them, and you know, how think about what that other person might have gone through or what they're going through, and that's got to be a good thing. But you know, as I say, we haven't heard back from people. People after the sessions message us, say how much, but you know, since then we don't know.
Yeah, and I think finally, looking ahead then, we've acknowledged that it's a long road, isn't it? This is a long process, and there's a lot of work that's still yet to be done, and there's a lot of good work that's happening right now, but it's a long journey. And the final thing really then is, from your perspective, are things improving within the sports media industry? Are things getting better?
Yeah, I think I'd have to say yes. I think there's people who would tell you no. I'm going to tell you my view. From what I've seen, I think yes. I think on screen, on radio, behind the scenes, I think there's a big push to make things better. And I'm not just talking about BBC Sport here. I'm talking about my friends who work at other broadcasters. Like, there are things going on, and whether they're good enough or not, things are going on, and people are looking at their practices and looking at the way they do things. And you see, you know, we've got female commentators, we've got black commentators, which didn't exist so many years ago. We've got young people being given a chance and having a say, and having a valid say, you know. And we've got people listening, and I think listening is a big thing. There's nothing worse than being told, this is what you're going to do about, this is how we're going to treat it. Just listen, hear people, you know. In all the measures, no one had ever spoken to me about racism before at the BBC. No boss had ever spoken to me about issues that were going on, which is fine. Like, what? Why necessarily would they? But there are certainly more senior people who could have been approached. They weren't. And so I think for the bosses, I think a lot of people suddenly thought, okay, there's, you know, there's people who carry weight and have valid, you know, valid arguments about these things. I wish that we'd be used more and asked more. But I think there's this thing about releasing control and power, and I think businesses need to, for their own good, need to try and hold on to it and be in control of how things work. But I think actually you should talk to people, you should listen to the minorities, you should certainly listen to the white people who might have issues with you know, things that are being, measures that are being put in place to help and promote minorities. Definitely listen to them. Just like I would say, you know, like with Trump, you have to listen to his supporters, because if you try and ignore them, you know, you're cutting off 78 million people. You know, you have to hear those people's views, and you have to address them as much as you address the minorities' views. And then it just becomes a massive quagmire. Where do we go, and whose views are more important in a sense? But, you know, I think in essence, you've got to do what's right. And if doing what's right upsets some people, then so be it. And I think the sports industry are trying to do what's right. My answer to your question is yes, things are getting better, but they have to keep getting better. They can't just stall. They have to keep getting better and keep getting better and keep getting better.
I just want to end this episode by saying a final thank you to Nelson for sharing his powerful experiences of working in the sport media. His story, which is similar to many others out there, is a powerful one, and it illustrates that greater action is required if the sport media industry and society in general is truly ever going to be more welcoming, inclusive, diverse, and progressive. And because we've explored so much here, we've had to split this episode on sports media into two parts. So join me in part two, where I'll be talking to sports journalist, broadcaster, and founder of the Black Collective of Media in Sport, otherwise known as BCOMS, Leon Mann. We'll be talking about inclusion and diversity in the sport media and activism and ways forward. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you in part two.